Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-753-7842. And now, your favorite and mine, For Science.
Thanks, Sam. Today's For Science is about some of the unexpected results of our changing climate. It's no secret that human activities, particularly the burning of fossil fuels, are changing the world around us. From global warming to ocean acidification to rising sea levels, we've really gotten ourselves in, if you'll forgive the pun, Sam, hot water. While we've known this was happening for decades and did nothing, and our climate scientists have been pretty good at foreseeing some of the changes that have occurred, there's still plenty of surprises of both the curious and terrifying varieties to come. Scientists have predicted that as global temperatures warm, disease-carrying pests like mosquitoes and ticks will expand their territories. That's pretty scary stuff, since a lot of really nasty diseases like malaria, yellow fever, and Zika virus have been typically limited to the tropics. Well, now such diseases are finding their way into historically temperate regions, like the United States. That's certainly bad news, but it's as we expected. What we didn't count on were diseases rising again from the Arctic's frozen graves. In July, Siberia experienced a deadly anthrax outbreak, a disease that hadn't been seen there since 1941. So where did it come from? Well, it appears that permafrost, ground that's frozen year-round, is melting due to global warming. As the permafrost melted, a long-frozen reindeer carcass was exposed. It turns out that this carcass was infected with anthrax. One child has now died of the disease, 9 more people have been hospitalized, and over 2,000 reindeer have been lost to the outbreak. Bacillus anthracis, the bacteria that causes this often fatal disease, proliferates by spores which can survive incredibly harsh conditions for centuries. As the permafrost continues to melt, this isn't likely to be the only outbreak that occurs, and anthrax isn't the only deadly disease locked away in the ice. But diseases aren't the only surprises that come with the melting Arctic. One of the least understood of all whales, and one of the most popular of internet memes, the narwhal, is on the receiving end of an entirely unexpected catastrophe. Narwhals, the unicorns of the sea, so named for the long spiraling tusks sported by mature males, are rapidly losing their habitat. In the winter, narwhals move to offshore areas covered in thick ice to hunt. As Arctic sea ice continues to recede year by year, the Greenland halibut and polar cod that live beneath that ice, the narwhal's main prey items, are also becoming scarce. Historically, the narwhals were safe from their usual predators beneath the thick winter ice, but in open water, narwhals are pursued by the ocean's top predators, the orca whale. However, the orca's tall dorsal fins make life under the ice uncomfortable if not impossible for them. While narwhals have no dorsal fin and can better exploit the few available cracks to take a breath of air. As the ice recedes, the narwhals are left with no place to hide. Arctic orcas are on the rise as their prey is more available, and these clever hunters are also taking more seals, larger whales like the endangered bowhead, and even polar bears. The 1-2-3 combo of warming oceans, reduced habitat, and increased predation may spell doom for narwhals, larger whales, seals, walruses, polar bears, and the numerous tribes of Inuit peoples that rely on them. So, we've talked about melting permafrost on the land and receding sea ice in the Arctic Ocean, but there's one more kind of ice that poses a much, much greater threat to us. This cataclysm of tremendous scale won't come as a surprise to scientists, except that the when and where it could happen are totally unknown. Thousands of feet beneath the ocean surface, methane from decomposing organic matter becomes locked in a crystal lattice with water, forming what's known as methane hydrates, methane clathrates, or fire ice. Seabed drilling operations have revealed that these formations are much more common features of the seabed than previously thought. They represent tremendous amounts of sequestered methane, or natural gas, a greenhouse gas 84 times more potent than CO2. While these hydrate formations, many of which are tens of kilometers across, seem to sleep, they are remarkably unstable. Small changes in ocean temperature can cause them to suddenly destabilize, reverting to a gaseous state. When this occurs, huge swaths of seabed can very suddenly loosen and fall. This event is known as a Storegga slide and is well recorded in our geological records. As you can imagine, enormous landslides at sea result in enormous tsunami waves striking the land. The largest known Storegga slide involved a landslide of over 290 kilometers of continental shelf, moving more than 3,500 cubic kilometers of seabed, and resulted in a tsunami that struck Scotland as far as 80 kilometers inland to a depth of 4 meters over high tide levels. That's definitely something to take seriously, given that 634 million people in this world including 39% of Americans, live in low-lying coastal areas where they're most vulnerable to both surprise tsunamis and the already expected sea level rise. Nature is full of surprises, some good, some bad, but what surprises me is just how vulnerable we've made ourselves and how very little our government and industry leaders are doing about it. We're rapidly running out of time to convince them, so make your voice heard. For nature, for humanity, and for science. The evidence is clear. The time to act is now.
If you have a scientific question or topic that you'd like to hear about on the podcast, phone in at 844-753-7842 or go to askanatheist.tv and click on the shiny red candy-like button. So one thing that sort of stood out to me as an interesting idea that you could probably answer fairly well, given what we're talking about, is you're talking about the habitat changes leading to an increase in Arctic orca populations.
Yes.
And orcas are an endangered species, are they not?
Certain populations of orcas are considered endangered. However, the species as a whole worldwide is doing okay. The difficulty is that each pod of orcas, or each clan of orcas, as we call groups of multiple pods,
right,
have their own sort of unique culture, their own unique languages that they don't share with orcas in other parts of the world. Orcas that don't use the same language don't interbreed. So each population could be considered sort of its own, what we call in biology, ESU, evolutionarily significant unit.
Okay.
Meaning they are a closed population pool. The same thing is true of many populations of salmon, many populations of salamanders. ESU is slowly becoming the preferred term over species because it's a lot more specific and useful. But orcas worldwide are doing okay. Our southern resident orcas here in the Salish Sea on the west coast of the United States are in incredibly deep trouble. There's only about 80 left, and they're on the decline.
Okay.
But the Arctic orcas, which are primarily mammal eaters and a little bit more opportunistic and not very picky about their prey, pose a serious threat to lots of other species up there. One of the biggest difficulties in Alaska with rebuilding sea otter populations is that the orcas up there don't have as many stellar sea lions to eat as they would prefer and have begun opportunistically taking sea otters. A sea otter doesn't represent a big snack for an orca that size, so they kind of have to eat more of them. And a sea otter's pretty easy prey compared to a stellar sea lion, which is extremely fast and powerful, can dive deep, and has large teeth and claws to defend itself.
Right. It also seems like a population boom that in the end would be completely unsustainable, since it depends on rapid habitat change in order to create that population boom.
Right. Yeah, What's really happening is that these Arctic orcas are sort of exploiting the receding edge. What they're feeding on is animals that are having to work harder to find their prey, to travel longer distances in open water than they should have to because of receding sea ice. So we used to have polar bears that might have to swim, you know, a few hundred meters to get from one ice floe to another to hunt seals.
Right.
But as the ice recedes, the seals are more scarce. We have polar bears that are swimming tens of kilometers through open water. And, you know, a polar bear is a big dangerous animal on land, but compared to a pod of mammal-eating orcas in the water, it's pretty easy pickings.
So this might be sort of out of left field, so feel free to just say, I don't know. But an article I read recently was about the return of pelicans to Lake Washington and how they're not really supposed to be here, and that might be a result of climate change.
There are kind of a lot of complicated problems with Lake Washington in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Not the least of which is that I believe it has over 50 species of introduced fishes and invertebrates.
Right. Some of them introduced on purpose by people who had an actual idea. Some of them introduced by people who said, "Eh, this would be cool to fish."
Right. Yes. Some people were you know, working for the state and said, "We're going to put some sport fish in here." Other people dumped out their fish tanks or, you know, brought buckets over from east of the mountains and dumped stuff into the lake.
Right.
So we have a really bizarre thing going on in Lake Washington. You know, as we used to joke in the lab when we were doing the studies on cutthroat trout in Lake Washington, we'd use the line from Aliens, you know. Nuke it from orbit. It's the only way to be sure. Because there's no way that you can go into a lake that is that sort of infested and damaged with all of these invasives and introduced species and actually restore it to a pristine state.
It's, right.
It is too far gone.
there's no real clear idea of what right. normal ever was for this thing.
Right,
So you got to aim for some stable abnormality.
It's like dealing with other invasive species like Japanese knotweed or Himalayan blackberry.
Right.
Eradication is not possible. What is possible is control and mediation, you know,
okay.
and that's about it. When you disturb an ecosystem, there's always going to be something that's waiting to exploit that.
Right.
When humans disturb an ecosystem, we have dozens of what we call synanthropes, animals that do better where humans do better, might be sort of in the lower levels in a natural environment or just on the fringes of forest or mountain environments. But when humans come in and make changes and we make all of these divisions between different ecosystems and all of these sort of like corridors, like our highways and our railroads, you have these synanthropes, these edge margin animals, suddenly doing great. Every city in the United States has rock doves.
Right.
The pigeons of the city that we know of. Certainly an indigenous species, but we create environments where they do better. They become overpopulated, then they become vectors for disease, for not just themselves, but for humans, for other animals.
And we're not talking about the obvious ones like rats, cats, and dogs, and raccoons that people seem to take with them. These are other species.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay, those count? Or?
Well, raccoons are definitely, you know, they're another indigenous species that
right.
just does better where humans do.
Crows.
Crows, for sure. Crows are amazingly talented synanthropes. The population of crows in North America is significantly higher than it was before we started building all these cities because, you know, crows are clever and they know how to follow a human schedule and watch what we do and figure out where to exploit our resources. The same thing's true with coyotes, white-tailed deer. Lots of animals are sort of artificially overpopulated because humans are artificially overpopulated.
I remember white-tailed deer from Chicago where they would have such an overpopulation problem with deer in the forest preserves. And in the Chicago area, there's actually a lot of them around mm-hmm. where they would occasionally have to order a cull where they'd have hunters come in to the forest preserve to winnow down the populations
right.
because you had deer dying of starvation, mm-hmm. leaving the forest preserves, causing issues elsewhere, and just basically so many of them, they're kind of tearing down the forest.
Right. And a big part of that is that, you know, in our efforts to feel safe in our homes and towns, we tend to eradicate the large predators that mm-hmm. would be keeping
like
those
wolves?
Deer on the move. Like wolves, yes.
Yeah. Now, wolves are long gone from Illinois. I don't know if they were ever there. To be then, that's how.
But also, we tend to drive out, you know, the bobcats and lynx that might prey on a young deer.
Right.
The bears and cougars that might prey on adult deer. We tend to drive those predators out as well because we consider them a threat to ourselves. As a result, we have overpopulated deer, and with those overpopulated deer, we've brought agriculture and gave them a perfect place to get all the food they could ever want in a nice flat landscape where they could see their predators coming from a long ways away. They become artificially overpopulated to the point where they're a problem for our crops. Then we have to do something about it. Whereas if we had left some of the large predators here, if we had chosen not to eradicate the wolves, we would be losing less money from having to control deer because the wolves will chase them for us and keep them on the move.
So they're synanthropic organisms? Is that the word?
Synanthropes, yes.
Yeah,
animals
okay.
that do, well, organisms in general that do better when humans are
around. I assume there are some water born versions of these animals. Like what happens in a lake when there's a lot of people nearby?
When there's a lot of people nearby in a lake, the immediate thing that you're going to see is what's called eutrophication.
Okay.
Where the human wastes, both the sewage and the runoff bearing fertilizers and things that we like to use in our gardens, makes its way into the water and causes algal blooms. So you have algae that now have all of the previously limiting fertilizer that they could ever want. The algae becomes so thick that the water is turbid.
Oh, yeah.
low visibility. So then only the algae that are near the surface are getting enough sunlight to survive. The algae below them die off, sink to the bottom. And as they decompose, they absorb the oxygen out of the water and re-release it as CO2 and as methane. This causes a dead zone just below the surface, which kills everything else, which leads to more decomposing life on the bottom. And eventually you get a lake that is basically just slime, you know, okay. A thick layer of slime at the surface and not much else living in it. So some great synanthropes in aquatic environments are the algae that can exploit the amount of nitrogen that we'll put in, but also the zooplankton that will feed on some of those algae.
Catfish?
Catfish, not so much.
Okay.
Catfish, you know, despite their sort of reputation for being murky swamp dwellers,
they actually need oxygen.
They need oxygen, yeah. And they need a pretty healthy environment. They're not really catfish are a huge, huge family of fishes, but most of them, at least that are indigenous to North America, are kind of apex predators in their environment.
Okay.
So they need those small fish. They need those crayfish. You know, they need those larger organisms to feed on. The algae is just not going to do it for them.
So we're talking about the sort of the microclimates and environments that create this larger problem that you ended the Four Science segment on, which is kind of seabed explosion,
yeah,
world ends, everything underwater. I am obviously overdoing it, but I mean, it sounds like
you're not as far off as you might suspect. I mean, during one of the breaks, we were talking about how those methane things might be responsible for some of the boat disappearances in certain parts of the world, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's one possible explanation for certain disappearances. A lot of people throw it around for, you know, the Bermuda Triangle. Oh, this is what's going on. Well, statistically speaking, things don't actually disappear any more than anywhere else in the Bermuda Triangle. In fact, they disappear less there, but it's just been one of the most heavily trafficked areas of the world for 600 years. But there have been disasters, especially in the Arctic and around places where there are known to be large methane clathrates on the seabed. And there's actually video of methane clathrates suddenly destabilizing beneath an oil rig and nearly sinking it because the water has become so full of bubbles of this gas that the water is no longer dense enough to support the rig's weight.
This may be sort of a null question, but we tend to separate ice formations from other minerals. It's like ice isn't a rock, it's ice.
Right.
But methane clathrates?
Clathrates.
I'm better with methane hydrates. I know how to pronounce that one.
You can say that too. It works.
Okay.
The same thing.
Oh, it is. Yeah. All right. But is it just ice with methane in it? Is it a mineral or is that a null question?
It's a lattice.
Okay.
So it's a crystalline formation where methane, one molecule of methane is surrounded by several molecules of water and just sort of locked in this, unusual stasis.
Right.
But it's very sensitive to slight changes in temperature and slight changes in pressure. And when you have, you know, one part of it beginning to destabilize, it can change the pressure throughout the entire area to the point where you get this chain reaction destabilization.
Right. And so the idea is that this stuff forms and then seabed forms like with that integrated into it or just on top of it.
Right. Some of it is sort of incorporated in almost like gravel. Some of it is, you know, there's huge formations that are almost like icebergs on the sea bottom covered in, you know, marine snow and sediment of the thousands of years that this stuff has been sequestered.
Is it just integrated in other substrates or are these methane hydrates actually heavier than water?
They are heavier than water. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But cool. But they can only form under certain conditions of pressure and temperature. So
right.
You know, if you brought one to the surface, it would destabilize long before you got it there.
Right. And so what happens is water heats up. This, you know, the ice turns into a liquid phase, releasing the methane, which is enormous. You know, you get another runaway greenhouse scenario. But now you got this big void where there used to be something holding up all the seabed stuff, and it just sort of collapses.
Tremendous collapse,
All right.
As a huge amount of a greenhouse gas 84 times more potent than CO2 is suddenly released into the atmosphere.
Right.
Causing more greenhouse effect and the potential of destabilizing the next bed of methane hydrates.
So 4 meters of water 80 kilometers inland?
Yeah, that's what happened in Scotland. It was about 6,000 years ago.
I was going to say, not our lifetimes, right?
No, we've had small Striga slides in our lifetimes.
Most recently... Or for an example, do you have one in mind?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay.
No,
But I think for an instance, this was a tsunami caused by an earthquake, but is it the 2011 Tohoku earthquake? Mm-hmm. I think the tsunami only made it 15 clicks inland. And right. if you look at the, just how the damage involved in that one, now multiply that by a factor of 4+.
Right.
And you're talking about places that are sensitive to a tsunami that, even by our own disaster estimates, are not in tsunami areas. This mm-hmm. this is a significant it's kind of scary and right. strong medicine, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's the real thing about this. We haven't taken seabed cores all over the world.
Right.
But the more that we take, the more that we find that this stuff is much more common than we previously thought. Which means that you don't have to be anywhere near a fault line or an earthquake zone to be a victim of a tsunami.
Right.
But also that we have no way of predicting where and when a Storega slide could occur.
Well,
we know where some large formations are. We don't know where all of them are. And we don't know what's going to destabilize any particular one of them, because the ocean temperatures and currents, and especially what's going on with climate change, where we're having things like the warm blob, our Pacific decadal oscillation is getting strange,
right.
our El Niños and La Niñas are getting strange. It's becoming less and less predictable.
Yeah, the two-year swap of the upper atmosphere failed to happen for a few months this year. It's getting really strange out there. I try not to end these things on such a negative note, but when you start talking about 80-kilometer inland tsunamis, I mean, mm-hmm. research, activism, that's basically what we're asking for here, right?
That is what we're asking for. Yeah, is activism. We are running out of time, and we're seeing, predicted result after predicted result, things that we've known were going to happen for 30 plus years. Now happening one
right.
by one. When we talk about it in science, it's not climate change will occur. It's climate change is occurring.
Yeah.
And how much can we still save?
It's an interesting conversation. When I was in high school and I was being told about climate change in the classroom, it was, this is what's going to happen in the future. If we don't do something now, this is what's going to happen. We did some things. I mean, it's not like everybody sat
right.
on their asses, but it clearly wasn't enough to stem the tide. And now it stopped being a situation of, this is what's going to occur, and it's turned into a situation of, this is occurring now.
Yeah, this is occurring, and guess what? There are still surprises we did not foresee.
Right. This is Ask an Atheist, 844 Skeptic, 844-753-7842. We'll be back after the break.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American Soccer League.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-free football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com. I want to bring it back, but it's more than
basic. I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is the United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio Versus the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
My name is Jonathan Ariola of TDTF Pod. The more voices you hear, the more we observe and feel, the more we learn about the other facets facets of this complex and wondrous beast that is humanism and free thought. Join me on the science-loving journey through topics like justice, murder, family, diligence, taste, history, society, race, boob jobs, law, addiction, video games, fear, sacrifice, children. Wait, not sacrificing children. That's not what I meant. Bring the popcorn and watch me break down the issues too deep, too fast. Join me at TDTF Pod. I'm Jonathan Ariola. Talk to you soon.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. And I've got some people to thank. I'd like to thank Rick from Elma, Alexander from the Internet, and Movie Man from the Internet in meeting Peggy's Challenge. Peggy's Challenge is the challenge to the listeners of Ask an Atheist by Peggy from local Kent to help us keep the lights on. Every dollar you give us goes directly towards show production. You can go to askanatheist.tv, click on the yellow button on the right-hand side, takes you directly to our PayPal page. Every dollar you give us goes directly towards show production. I'd also like to thank Chase from Melbourne, Florida, for becoming my patron. Yes, I have a Patreon now. It's going very well. And you can go to our website, click on the Patreon icon, and it goes directly to our Patreon page. I don't really have a shtick for this one yet. We are on month 3 of the Patreon. It's going very well. We've released our first Patreon-only podcast this week, and it's got a lot of stuff I wouldn't normally do on the show here. A lot of stuff that we talk about that may not have anything to do with atheism. In fact, that's kind of the idea. If it's about atheism, we want to, you know, it's part of our activism. We want to keep it on the show. So we talk about weird secret stuff, tea, and some experimental radio stuff I'm doing. So we have this news piece, which in my show notes, it has kind of a, it has a big disclaimer on it. And rather than just not do the story because we're not sure, I thought we should talk about the disclaimer because I've been seeing this story all over the place.
Yeah.
Icelandic road workers will clear debris covering a rock to appease elves. The rock, called the Elfin Lady Stone, was covered when road crews were cleaning up after a landslide. Locals believe the rock is a home to elves who were angered after it was covered. After a number of incidents, including the road flooding, some industrial equipment failing, and journalists falling in a mud pool, the Iceland Road Administration decided to uncover the rock. According to polls as recently as 1998, over half of people in Iceland believe in elves and supernatural creatures. Well, I guess the first things first is, as somebody who's done maintenance, not necessarily on roads, but somebody has done maintenance, well, get people to stop talking about it. All right, I'll uncover the rock, whatever.
All right. Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I'm not too familiar with the elfin mythology of Iceland.
Right.
But the sort of Tuatha De Danann mythology of Ireland and Great Britain are a little bit more familiar to me, where the elves sort of rule the underground and the humans rule the overground. And
okay.
There was a war about it because humans had iron, which is like deadly to elves. And the elves had magic. They fought to a stalemate and then made this agreement. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty common variation of the elf myth, though, is that they're underground and that they're coming through like the fairy rings, you know, rings of mushrooms and stuff like
so
that.
So they're coming through the floors, you're saying?
Basically, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Coming through the floors, yeah.
Yeah, very good.
And
I got something. Hey.
You got something.
Yeah.
You got something. All right. I know there's sort of a lot of like local superstition, and sometimes I think the sort of cultural value of the superstition is what makes it worth doing.
Right.
You know, that by the government coming in and clearing the debris from the rock, you know, they're not necessarily saying that we as government officials believe in the existence of elves so much as they're saying, our culture has a fun tradition and we're all going to play along. Kind of like our weather service, you know, showing us where Santa Claus is on Christmas Eve.
Right.
You know, and I mean, as far as supernatural beliefs go, belief in elves is pretty relatively harmless. I mean, there are worse things to believe
in. Well, I mean, I know there are some, there's some elven mythologies that, you know, this goes back to like something we used to do in the early days of Ask an Atheist, which is episodes that Mike used to do called Where's the Harm, where we would take something relatively innocuous and show what happens when it's basically allowed to go without any skepticism applied to it.
Right.
And there's a lot of like stories about elves or some other creatures that kind of look like traditional elves stealing kids and stuff like that. And that could, you know, that you that could take you in some very weird directions.
That's true. I mean, there is the whole concept of like the elf queen kidnapping children who wandered off into the woods sort of thing. And
but then David like, Bowie shows up. Wait, sorry. Wrong story.
But yeah, I mean, that sort of thing, like, yes, lying to children can be harmful.
Right.
But in that sense, like elves, they're fun and you know, but of course, like, yeah, okay, some journalists fell into a mud puddle.
Like, maybe that's what this is about. Maybe this is like some journalists fell into a mud puddle and go, yeah, Iceland sucks. I'm going to stick it to them by writing a story about how they're all dumb.
I can see that happening, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not saying I do it. It's saying I understand the draw. But so we got this story, and you know, I look at it in my show notes, and I go, oh, hey, yeah, all right. Let's talk about elves. That's not something I've done before. But then there's this huge disclaimer attached to it, which I'm going to just read in its entirety. I found this story in a few places, but they all had the exact same article, including the same typos. I think the article was originally French, which could explain the typos. However, something about this has my BS detector tingling. You might want to look at this to see if you can get better confirmation before airing the story. The Atlantic article I linked is a wider look at Icelandic beliefs about elves and such, so it's not impossible or even unlikely that the story is true. Just wanted to give you a heads up that this could be fake. So, one, it's a neat little slice into how sometimes how research is done and how we test stories in Ask an Atheist. But I really liked it because it seemed like a good example of what a good BS detector should do.
Yeah. I think that's a great thing about doing this kind of research. I mean, whether you're in science or whether you're in journalism, it does teach you to try to sniff these things out. And, you know, they once in a while, a story will get past all of us. Nobody's, you know, nobody's perfect about it.
I'm not saying it happens frequently, but it's happened a few times on Ask an Atheist.
It certainly has.
Yeah. I mean, we did a whole episode on it the other day.
Right. Yeah. That's one of the challenging portions about writing the for science pieces is that sometimes there's something that just sort of grabs you as you're going through the literature that's like, well, this little thing is just so fascinating. Now I'm going to make the piece about this. And, you know, three articles into reading about it, you read a review of the most outlandish of the articles that was going to be, you know, your favorite piece, and find that, oh, actually, this article has been retracted, and the author of the article has been publicly shamed. You know, it's like, God, man, I really wanted to believe that one. That one sounded really good. But.
Yeah, has a degree from the first University of Olympus Mons or something.
Right, yeah.
What I liked about this one is a huge tell for me as somebody who's not a scientific researcher but reports on news and follows journalism pretty closely, is that when you see the same, especially in the modern internet age where it's very difficult, I mean, you can Google search to find the original source of something, but everything kind of points at everything else. Mm-hmm. And when you see the exact same words showing up in the exact same stories, complete with typos, suggesting that there's been no rewriting, no fact-checking, no research by the quote-unquote journalist doing the subject, covering the subject, it should set off your BS detector. You go, all right, something about this ain't right. I mean, one, if I see a typo in a journalist, you know, in an article, I go, is this a blog or is this a newspaper article?
Right.
Because it's a hard thing to detect these days. The other thing is to see the same article appearing in several different places with the exact same words, the exact same phrases, the exact same misspellings without attribution. Because the other side of that is you've got a lot of newspapers and a lot of magazines reprinting articles word for word because they subscribe to a wire service like the Associated Press or Reuters.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole purpose of Associated Press or Reuters and organizations like that is that they write these stories and they send them to other news organizations for reprinting. But when that usually happens, it's in the byline. It'll say, you know, AP and then an M dash and then the story, or Reuters M dash story, or like somewhere towards the bottom, it'll tell you that this is a story from the wire service.
Mm-hmm.
And for articles like this, especially on bloggy kind of journalism sites like The Atlantic or Huffington Post, you're not certain they're not going to attribute it in the same way. So you don't know where it's coming from. So you go to the Google search and you see a pile of articles where it's all written the same thing. So it's very difficult to determine the source. I mean, you can look at dates, but you can backdate on the internet easily.
Mm-hmm.
And that ends up... And the part where I can't, you know, the narrative kind of ends for me is when I imagine this might be Dave, where it says the article's in French. The original article may in fact be in French. Well, I don't speak French, so
right.
I mean, that's where the trail goes cold.
Mm-hmm.
And so on a story like this, where it has a disclaimer that says, you know, the BS detector is going off, I go, well, I'm not doing this story because... You know, if I talk about the story online and then somebody who happens to speak French has read the article and says, no, it's complete crap, or they know something I don't, I'm going to get it in the neck, as I should. Then to see it, this is like, you know, wait, actually, sort of a meta story here we can talk about. Anything like that happened recently in your work in the seas?
In my work? You know, actually, there's this one, like, really pervasive myth that,
okay.
that we come across everywhere working in marine science in the Pacific Northwest, and it's about the Pacific giant octopus.
Okay.
The world's largest octopus, depending on who you ask, they have varying sizes. The actual scientific literature supports that this species can grow to 200 pounds and be approximately 30 feet long from the tip of one tentacle to the tip of the next.
Right.
So... you know, roughly 15, 16 feet long if all tentacles are folded back and
yeah, if they're,
sort of cruising.
If they're doing jazz hands.
Right, if they're doing jazz hands, yeah, 30 feet. Yeah.
Okay.
but you'll find all over the place that they can reach 600 pounds and 30 feet. And it's like, and where did this 600-pound thing come from? Nobody seems to know. Nobody can track it down. But if you talk to people colloquially who aren't, you know, like teuthologists that are into the study of cephalopods and they know a little bit about the natural history of the area, you'll very likely hear them say that these octopus can reach 600 pounds. And it's just one of these things where nobody's exactly sure where it came from. We haven't been able to find like the first place that appears in print. But how do you go from 200 pounds to 600 pounds just sort of off the cuff, you know, just...
You write the two, like, backwards?
Yeah,
I was thinking, well, did they mean 200 yards? Wait, no, that's not it.
No, that's huge.
200 to 600 yards, that would work.
That's a sci-fi movie.
200 to 600 pounds. Was it 200 kilos? No, that's more like 4,400 pounds, or 440 pounds. But yeah, it's just one of those, like, where did this come from? But you'll hear it repeated over and over and over in the Pacific Northwest that these animals can get to three times their actual weight.
Yeah, I think I may have been sensitive to that one, but mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like I've met one, so...
Yeah, it's, I mean, you have probably heard it before. It's,
yeah,
you'll hear it all over at the Pacific Northwest. You won't hear it from, like, docents at the aquarium, but you'll often hear it from, like, beach naturalists, and it's even in some books about octopus.
Okay. That's strange.
Isn't it?
Yeah. All right. Well, this is... I think that's all the time we've got for today. This is Ask an Atheist. Our phone number is 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Our email is questions@askanatheist.tv. Our Twitter is askanatheistwa. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Bridget.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Dave, for being a good fact checker. See you guys next week. And that's the end of this podcast. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv. Email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. You can voicemail us at 844-753-7842. That's 844-SKEPTIC. You can visit us on Twitter on AskAnAtheistWA. This episode was pre-recorded. Thank you guys very much. See you next week.